This episode of Gunblog Varietycast brought to you by LawOfSelfDefense.com. Go to LawOfSelfDefense.com/variety to learn about your state's self-defense laws. Sign up for one of their online or in-person seminars or buy the book Law of Self-Defense and get 10% off when you use the discount code VARIETY at checkout. That's LawOfSelfDefense.com/variety.
Welcome to another episode of the Gunblog Variety Cast with your hosts, Sean Sorrentino and Aaron Paulette.
Welcome to Gunblog Variety Cast episode 98. I'm Sean.
And I'm Aaron Paulette, soon to be queen of all media.
What?
I will have you know that I am a very important person in great demand with the media these days.
Well, thanks. I'm glad that you managed to slum it down to our little podcast, now that you're all famous on BBC and everywhere else.
Well, I was always told to never forget the little people, and you'll always be my first little person, Sean.
Well, thanks. I'm always glad to be called a little person by somebody of your stature. That's a good way to put it.
Goodness.
So we no longer have a Tactical Dog and Fitness Report because, well, the format's changed a little with Aaron now being the co-host.
Yeah, and just like a woman, you invite her in, and next thing you know, she's redecorating and rearranging things.
But that doesn't mean we're not going to talk about our dogs, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, so Dices decided it would be all kinds of fun to chase a deer yesterday and was gone for 5.5 hours.
Yeah, we've had that happen too. We've got woods that are just right in the back of the house, and we've got deer and squirrel and raccoons, and we have to keep a tight rein on our dogs, because anytime they hear anything in the forest, they will run out and chase them. And it's a big concern, because unlike in North Carolina, we've got alligators. and there is at least a drainage canal within, I don't know, a few hundred feet of the backyard. So when they go running out and they come back and they're all muddy, that's worrisome for me. So I completely get where you're coming from. 5 hours. Wow.
5.5.
Well, she's gone for 5 hours, and is an extra 30 minutes really that important?
Yeah. It was 30 more minutes of my dog coming back, or is she dead in the middle of the road someplace? So I'm thinking about maybe putting a GPS tracker on the dog in case. Because, you know, this happens once in a great while. She'll see something and chase it. Now, it was a subdivision we used to live in, so she'd chase a squirrel in what passed for woods in a subdivision. You know, you just chase her around until you get her back. So, you know, you'd go a couple of months and she'd never be off the leash. And then you'd break down and let her go to the front yard and chase a frisbee. Because, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually we're going to let her loose again. I think it's probably a good idea to spend the $150 and put a GPS tracker on her collar.
No, she's already microchipped, right?
She is, but you know what? I would much rather track her than hope that somebody takes her to the vet to get the chip scanned.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And doesn't just say, oh, what a great dog, I'm keeping her.
Did you just wait for her to come back, or was there some sort of a bribe involved?
No, I wish I'd have waited till she came back, because that's what ended up happening. I went out and tromped all the way through the marsh and woods, to the point where when I went to the doctor, you know, remember we were talking about my knee?
Uh-huh.
More on that later. But when we went to the doctor looked at my legs and said, do you have a cat? Wait a minute, vines is what they're called.
Oh, yes. I know exactly what those are.
So the last podcast report was that I had gone to get an MRI on my knee. We were concerned that there was possibly a torn meniscus. No torn meniscus. Everything is fine. There's nothing wrong with my knee at all, except I need to do some exercises and strengthen one of the muscles, and that should straighten the kneecap out. So,
hooray!
I go to PT on Friday. We'll see how that goes.
All right. No operation is always good news.
Yep, it is. This week on Pacifiers and Peacemakers, Beth sits down with new mom Carla Corrigan to talk about how being a new mom changes you and your mindset towards concealed carry.
Hey, Sean, this week I wanted to get together with a friend and coworker of mine to talk a little bit about what it's like to be a mom with a gun. Most specifically, Carla is a new mom. She has her very first baby girl who just had a birthday. So she has a one-year-old daughter that has changed her life in many, many ways. Carla, why don't you introduce yourself first and we'll get into talking about some good stuff.
Hi, Beth. I'm so happy to be here. Like you said, my name is Carla. I'm the copy editor of Concealed Carry Magazine and definitely had a huge life-changing event about a year ago with the birth of my daughter, Corrigan.
And think about that. Were you a concealed carry person before the birth of your daughter?
So I was definitely an advocate of concealed carry. Me and my husband did have guns in our household, but having her really changed the equation. It needed to be more practical. It needed to be more of a daily occurrence rather than just a backup plan, I guess you could say.
And do you feel like having a child made you more aware of situations around you, of things that could potentially happen, not only to you, but to her? How did that change your outlook just about going out and about and living your life the way you used to versus having a child?
Oh, I think it has changed things so dramatically. Everything from having people over and being around animals to taking walks and kind of just paying attention to where cars are on the street when I'm on the sidewalk because I'm pushing her along in a stroller, going out to the grocery store, and she has my attention all the time. There's this just new level of I have to make sure that she's okay. So definitely paying attention to everything that's happening around me and sort of how different things in the world are interacting with her, that became very, very important.
Absolutely. And as far as the concealed carry lifestyle, has the way that you've carried or the way that the gun even that you carry, have those things changed as far as having a child now that you have to hold or pick up or change diapers?
Well, to be honest with you, I was struggling before I had my daughter to find a really good place for me to carry. And it's complicated when you have a baby and you are carrying around a car seat and a diaper bag and a purse. All of a sudden, there's all these layers and you really have to start thinking about, holy cow, if something were to happen right at this moment, what sort of steps would I have to take to actually get to my gun? So I will just say that absolutely, that had a huge role in sort of my evaluation of the best and safest places to carry.
In addition to thinking about concealed carry and which gun you choose and what holster is going to be effective with a child, have you considered different options for training? Are there classes you've been interested in? Or are there things that you have gone through in your daily life to make sure that you can handle a firearm and your child and be safe?
Beth, that's definitely something that I think about. And I'm just going to be honest here. I read something from you recently that really got me thinking about this. I think that as a mom, your instinct obviously is to protect your child, to shield your child. But running through some different scenarios lately, I've come to the realization that I need to be willing to make some distance between me and my child rather than pulling in her close and trying to shield her protect her from a threat. I may have to just get her out of the way and kind of be that distraction and then be able to isolate the target and deal with the target one-on-one. It's a mindset change because I think it goes against our instinct, and anything that goes against our instinct requires practice. So I run through a ton of different scenarios, especially because so many of the things that we do involve taking walks outside, you know, we go for walks with our dog, things like that. So kind of looking at what would be my first reaction and then stepping back and saying, wait, is that really the right way to approach this situation?
Yeah, what is actually the best reaction yes. here instead of the first reaction? And you're right. I mean, that's something I was thinking about. And that article is actually going to be coming out in Concealed Carry Magazine in a few months. So maybe we can post information in the show notes. But that article was actually eye-opening to me, too, because as an instructor for firearms, I knew that obviously snatching my children and hanging on to them and running into a gunfight was a bad idea. But until you've changed your mindset, just like you've said, until you've actually thought through that scenario ahead of time, you're going to go with your basic gut instinct. You're going to grab your child. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, that could be a very, very bad decision. In fact, most times we would try to say, look, if you're pushing a stroller, you've got an infant and something uncomfortable is happening, the best thing to do is to find a safe spot or the safest area for that stroller and set it aside and then confront that issue, whatever it might be. Of course, if you have somebody with you, let that person take the children and get out of there. Mm-hmm. We've done a lot of scenarios with the USCCA. What would you do? And anytime there's a child or a family involved, we try to come up with the idea that, look, they need to get to safety and the person who stays behind, maybe that's the well-trained person. That's a person maybe with a firearm. Again, if you don't think about that in advance, you're not going to know what to do in that scenario. What are some words of advice or last words, Carla, that you might want to give to moms out there who are thinking about, is it a good idea for me to carry a firearm with a child? Or what can I do to keep my baby safe when I do carry a firearm?
You know, Beth, one of the things that I have noticed, particularly since becoming a mom, is that there is this automatic support system that you have. Every single mom, no matter where you live, no matter if you're a Republican or a Democrat, how much money you make, what your job is, we have a goal, and that is to keep our kids happy and safe and loved. And so I think that reaching out to other people is a very, very good place to start. Even if you have that little inkling of, you know, maybe there's something more that I can do. I promise you that there are people out there who have been in your same boat, who have been through some experiences and can maybe help make it a little bit less scary. For me, being a new mom, it was already overwhelming. I have this new life and holy crap, what do I do? Sometimes you feel so helpless. This is something that I don't want to say you can completely control, because you can't control life and what goes on around you. But heck, if you can do everything in your power to do what you can to take control of a bad situation by carrying a firearm and sort of having that extra layer, I just think it's a really, really smart, and it brings a little bit of comfort and peace to that whole process.
I love it, Carla. It's about planning, it's about preparation, it's about having the right mindset, and it's about reaching out and realizing that you're not alone. Thanks again, Sean. Until next time, stay safe and be well armed.
You can read more from Beth at usconcealedcarry.com/blog and click on Pacifiers and Peacemakers in the left sidebar.
This podcast runs on your donations. Go to gunblogvarietycast.com and click on the donate or the subscribe button in the right sidebar. You can make a one-time donation of any amount or subscribe for as little as $2 a month. I know that doesn't sound like much, but we pay our server costs monthly, and a little help from you is a big help to us.
Felons behaving badly. Mom shot while holding baby inside Wake County home. Man arrested. Dateline Wendell, North Carolina. A woman was shot while holding her baby at a home on Alfreda Court Friday evening in Wendell. Wake County Sheriff Donnie Harrison confirmed victim, 21, was shot at 3309 Alfreda Court.
Stop by and say hi.
Around 6 p.m. and transferred to the hospital. Suspect 36 of Nightdale was taken into custody in connection with the shooting, authorities said. Harrison said suspect was asked to leave a get-together at the house after an argument. Suspect left, then came back and shot into the house, hitting victim. She was holding her 2-month-old child at the time. The child was not hurt in the incident. Witness said she heard the gunshots and got down immediately. My heart was so shook up, I didn't know what to do, witness said. We were worrying about the baby. She said about a dozen family members were at the house when the argument started. My aunt told him to get out, and he wouldn't go. When they finally got him out the door, he said, I will be back, witness said. Victim was taken to Wake Med for treatment. Suspect was charged with assault with a deadly weapon with intent to kill or inflict serious injury, as well as discharging a weapon into occupied property causing serious bodily injury. He is being held at the Wake County Detention Center under a $500,000 secured bond.
So it's absolutely a good thing that the baby wasn't hurt. Let's just get that out of the way right now.
No argument there. So what kind of person do you figure gets into an argument at what sounds like a family gathering, gets thrown out, comes back, and shoots the place up?
I'm sure he's a church boy who's turning his life around.
I'm sure. I bet he sings brilliantly in the choir. Let's take a look at his permanent record. Wanton injury to persons and property greater than $200, misdemeanor class 2. 2 counts, drug paraphernalia, use, possess, misdemeanor class 1. Larceny, misdemeanor class 1. Resisting officer, misdemeanor class 1. Assault on a female, misdemeanor class A1. Felony breaking and entering, felon class H. And robbery with a dangerous weapon, felon class D.
Well, there you go.
But wait, there's more. the victim, resisting officer, misdemeanor class 2, and possessing stolen goods, misdemeanor class 1. Some family gathering, huh?
Well, at least she's not a felon.
But wait, there's still more! It's like a Ginsu knife commercial. Did I just date myself?
Yes.
Witness, drug paraphernalia, use, possess, misdemeanor class 1. And I would like to point out that according to the Department of Justice's website, she is currently 57 years old, and this was a 3-year-old offense, so she was charged at 54 with drug paraphernalia, use, possess.
Well, it just goes to show that you are never too old to start branching out in life.
That's true. I'm glad that for all the guns in my family, our get-togethers are a whole lot more sedate than that. You get a phone call from your bank's fraud department asking about overseas credit card transactions, but you still have your card. How could the scammers have gotten it? Baron tells us about credit card skimmers in
Tech Tips, Tech Tips, Tech Tips.
You are damaging my calm.
Tech Tips with the Baron.
So Baron, what's new this week?
Remember kids, it pays to be paranoid. Today's a tip to keep your credit card and debit card numbers from being stolen. Today, I'm talking about skimmers.
Those are those devices that attach to the front of an ATM, right?
Yep, and I bring it up because a researcher on vacation in Europe actually found one in the wild, which is actually a pretty fascinating thing. He saved others from getting their cards skimmed. He also now has a sample to reverse engineer and to figure out how it works.
Well, that's convenient.
Folks, before swiping your card at any ATM or even at a cash register, make sure the reader is firmly attached to the machine. Pull on it. Also inspect for seams or an attachment point. The main device will integrate with where the card will be inserted. While the primary attack point is ATMs, they've also been seen on point-of-sale systems and stores, mainly convenience stores. They usually drop over the entire front panel, leaving the buttons and screen exposed. They're usually dropped in place as they distract the person who's running the register. A light tug while looking for seams is all that's really necessary. In the incident like the one where they found one in the wild, there was actually visible glue around the edges where the seam of the device attached to the ATM.
Well, that sounds like a pretty easy check to make.
Yes, it is, and it's a simple habit to get into once you start doing it. Ultimately, you're doing you and the retailer or a bank a favor, because while you can get your money refunded, as the bank and retailer, they're victims of fraud. The bank and retailer are out the cash. Frankly, I'm surprised I don't see more heavy encouragement of this type of behavior.
Well, it's good to know that being paranoid does pay off.
It certainly can, Sean, and remember, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean that no one's out to get you.
All right, Baron, it was good to talk with you. I'll see you again next week.
See you next week, Sean.
Baron still blogs at the-minuteman.org.
So our main topic today is Aaron takes on the BBC.
Ah, jeez.
So how did that go exactly, Aaron? Give us a little background for those who may be joining us just recently.
Okay, so for people who don't know, the Monday after the Orlando murders, I started putting together a list on Facebook of all of the good-hearted gun owners who were willing to train LGBTQ people for no price. And this thing just snowballed out of control. It avalanched, and it's a wonderful problem to have. And because of this sudden attention I was getting, and I think also because I am an LGBTQ and I was close enough to Orlando that I was deemed interesting enough, and I got a contact from a researcher at the BBC who said, hey, we're going to have someone in your part of the state within the next few days. Could we interview you? Could we talk to you about this? And I wasn't sure if I wanted to do this or not. But enough people encouraged me, said that I would be a good representative, both of gun owners and LGBTQ, and that I had this, and I should go ahead and do it. And so after some back and forth with the BBC, I settled on a shooting range in Daytona Beach. I figured, in addition to just having the interview, it would be neat if I could get the BBC presenter to actually shoot guns. I could do a little bit of instruction along the lines of, hey, this is what I would do for anyone else who takes me up on my offer. Plus, I got the secret thrill of getting a person from the UK to actually shoot pistols in America. And so we worked everything out, and I got there, and I was nervous like I'll get out. And I know that Sean has some strong feelings about Stacey Dooley, specifically her accent, which he's going to get to in a minute. But I do want to say a few things about her. First of all, she was exceptionally kind. She put me at ease. She knew I was nervous and was a very calming influence. And she was very respectful towards me and towards my concerns. I'm also going to say that when we got on the firing line, she exhibited amazing trigger discipline. Her finger was not on the trigger until she was ready to fire, and for a first-time shooter, that was amazing. She didn't muzzle anybody, she kept her finger off the trigger, she observed the four rules, and that was fantastic. And so we shot for about 45 minutes, and we had some conversation on the firing line, which was difficult at times because we weren't the only people there. We had been told that if we got there first thing in the morning, that we would have the firing line to ourselves. And we get there before the store opens, and there are people lined up to go shooting. And I don't know exactly what all they were shooting, but it sounded like they were shooting something 30 caliber, because it was loud. And so it was difficult to have a good conversation on the firing line. The microphones picked it up really well. I'm impressed by that. But we had a hard time. Even with our amplified ear pro, we were still shouting at each other.
So how did the interview go?
After we did our shooting, we then put our guns away and adjourned to a nice area that overlooked the shooting range. And we had a good conversation for at least an hour. And she asked me a lot of good questions. Some of them I expected, some I didn't. And we just had what felt like a very friendly chat.
Well, I want to play a couple of the bits out of here. Basically, I'm just going to play your part of the whole segment. Though I do recommend everybody watch the entire segment. It's very well done. I don't have any real strong feelings about Stacey Dooley, except that her accent kills me. I have been informed that this is an Essex accent.
While some members of the LGBT community are marking the tragedy with tattoos, others are taking more radical steps, like Erin. The Pink Pistols is a group of pro-gay, pro-gun activists. Erin is setting up a chapter in Orlando to teach gay people how to shoot.
The Pink Pistols were founded on the philosophy that armed gays don't get bashed. And it's living proof that you can be LGBTQ and a gun owner.
The accent just kills me. The getting tattoos, I just can't handle it.
I do want to point out that I'm not starting a Pink Pistols chapter in Orlando. I don't know where she got that information. Mainly because Orlando is 60 miles away from me. And given traffic, that is somewhere around an hour and a half to 2 hours drive. So I'm not going to be doing that. But I might start one in Daytona. I'm currently looking into it.
Okay. Now, here's where I think you really made your money on this. The reason I'm playing some of these clips is because I'd like people to hear what it's like to give a good answer to what could be a gotcha question.
Do you think if they had have had guns in Pulse, the outcome may have been different?
I don't know. I wasn't there. But if you were trapped in a club with a madman for 3 hours, wouldn't you want the ability, the option to protect yourself? Because I would.
That's a gotcha question. Would they have been able to save themselves with guns? If you say yes, then she can pivot to, but there was a person there with a gun, the cop, and he got driven off. And you have to get into a back and forth about it. You also look like a big fat jerk.
It's their own fault they got killed.
Right. They keep twisting it into that, which I never understand. But they act like you're blaming the victim. And that's garbage. By being honest and kind of right up front and saying, I don't know. And then you pivot straight into, let me put it in the most reasonable way possible, stark terms. Let me put you in the situation. Now, do I hand you the gun to defend yourself? Or do you just say, I would rather be murdered than to touch that evil death machine and protect myself? And she's got two choices. She either agrees with you that she wants to defend herself, in which case you've proved your point. Or she says, no, I'd rather be murdered than touch that evil death machine. And she looks like an idiot. I mean, it's a brilliant way to put it. You did a great job.
Thank you. Now, credit where due. I came up with the general sentiment, but Sean is the one who refined it and polished it, because what I had was clunky and unwieldy and not at all a soundbite. Sean took that and polished it to a high sheen and handed it back to me wrapped in a bow.
I've been on camera before and I know what they do to you, and I've watched what they've done to others.
Yeah.
You knew what to say, but you roll it out like that. And that's the funny part, is listening to you say that in the clip, it doesn't look like you were just pulling it out of your back pocket and dropping it on her head like you'd brought it there. It sounded like you just considered the question, you were honest, and said, now think about this.
Well, that's mostly nerves, so I'm glad my being nervous helped with the sincerity of the interview.
Now, another question she had for you.
Do you believe that more people from your community should be owning guns, should be firing them?
I think more people in the LGBTQ community should make an effort to learn about firearms and find out if they are right for that individual person. Don't let fear of the unknown prevent you from learning a potentially life-saving tool.
Again, everybody needs to have a gun. You sound like an idiot. You sound like a crazy person. Especially to British people, you sound like we need to get this person mentally checked or something, because that's just insanity. But I think more people should make an effort to learn about firearms and decide for themselves if this is a good option for them. Well, who's going to argue with that? Only extremists. Let me find the comfortable middle of this argument, and I'm going to stand right in the middle of it. And in order to argue with me, you look like a jerk. I mean, like, wow.
God, I'm blushing so hard.
I don't know if you planned that, but you really did. Each time you gave an answer in this segment, you put her in a position where she either had to agree with you or she had to be the extremist. And she never reacts to the answer. The way she's edited the interview, she has ended that question with your response and not with her response to your response. She puts it on the audience who's watching this video now to either agree with your perfectly reasonable statement, how could anybody argue with this, or be an extremist. I thought that was pretty cool. And of course, we knew this one was coming.
Oh yeah.
This is something that polarizes Americans.
It does.
And it's so emotive. The idea to some people to just run out and make sure more people have more guns is ludicrous, because they're the very things that are causing these mass tragedies. Can you see that?
The thing is, you're blaming an inanimate object. We don't blame matches when houses burn down. So why are we blaming a gun when someone shoots someone? We blame the person.
This was another obvious gotcha question. I'm pretty sure you were expecting to get this.
Oh yeah, I've made this argument many times before.
Right, and it showed. You're like, let me just toss off this answer that is so easy. You just made it sound like, I say this every day. But what you did was, you're ludicrous. Why? When did you stop beating your wife? That's really what that question was. You're crazy. Can't you see that you're crazy? And instead of arguing the point, you're crazy, no I'm not, yes you are, no you're not, let me reframe your view of what you're talking about. Let's pivot away from something that is emotionally grabbing and painful for you. Oh my goodness, I can't handle this, to some ordinary object that has a negative use. You took away the power of it really fast.
Yeah, one thing I have learned in these kinds of discussions is if someone asks you a question like that, the first thing they want from you is either a yes or a no, and they can then proceed to attack you. And the best way to handle it is not to give them that initial yes or no. You take a breath, you answer in a complete sentence, you possibly rephrase it if necessary. Because the moment you give a quick, snappy yes, no, you've conceded so much.
Right. Don't argue on the ground that other people have chosen for you. Reframe and meet them on the ground that you have chosen beforehand. So, and you did that every single time. Now, this one really weirded me out. It was something that grabbed me, and I'm like, why is she saying this? But I think you had a very different take on it. Let me play it.
It's extraordinary to hear an LGBT activist using the same language as the gun lobby. But then I heard about an event that would show extreme homophobia is alive and well in America.
Now, I jumped all over this. I said, wait a minute. An LGBT activist uses the same language as the gun lobby. Oh, how can this nice person that I've spent this time with, that I just think is super nice, says the evil words out of the gun lobby? And we all know they're evil. They're terrible people. Anything they say is horrible. But this nice person said it. Oh, I can't keep that all in my head. But you took a completely different view of it, didn't you?
Yeah, I had a different take on this because the way I interpreted it was she was saying, well, it's really weird to hear someone say this, but now we're going to pivot to these people who obviously hate LGBTQ. And so maybe it makes a bit more sense to be carrying in the face of this very obvious and wanton hate.
I did not catch that until I saw you say that on Facebook. I'm like, wait a minute, that's true, because I'm so fixated on the one end of this statement. I didn't get the, oh, this is bad, but wait a minute, maybe she's got a point. That statement really is what it said.
I obviously think that the NRA makes good arguments, but if you have to put the NRA's arguments up against Westboro Baptist Church, which pretty much everyone agrees are douches, we're going to look even more reasonable and level-headed.
Right. Gandhi would have shot these people.
Yeah, I think so.
I think this was a really, really good example of exactly how gun people need to speak to the media. Oh, don't talk to reporters. Don't talk to baloney. We rely on reporters to take our message to everybody else, and we do it by forcing them to repeat our words to other people so they can, usually so they can mock us. But what happens is they attempt to mock us from that elitist view, and the people who reject that elitist view of the world, we must do what our betters say, go, those elitists suck, but boy, this person makes sense. In this case, you didn't get treated like an idiot and a fool that they were bringing out to mock, but typically that's what happens to us. In this case, she wrapped you up in a bow and served you out and then said, and then look at these horrible, nasty people that this very nice person who carries a gun might have to defend herself against.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I didn't catch that. That's only because I was offended by the first part and didn't hear the second part. People who are not offended by the first part will hear the whole sentence in context and go, oh, wait a minute.
Yeah, let's hope.
You did a fantastic job. So there's two things in the show notes. Check out the video, which Aaron gave me the link in such a way that it goes straight to her segment of the interview. But watch the whole video. You'll like it. I mean, if you can get past her accent. And the other thing, there's another link in the show notes that is the Blue Collar Prepping Midweek Update. And it's got a list of all the different articles and all kinds of stuff. And click through and read these things. I've been seeing them coming across Facebook. I'm like, man, she is dominating the media.
Yeah, I may only have 15 minutes of fame, but I'm going to use every second of it to do as much good as I possibly can.
And now a word from our sponsor. You know what will happen. If you ever have to defend yourself, you're going to end up in handcuffs. Are you trained to win the fight after the fight? Sure, you can draw, aim, and put two in the ten ring, but have you learned your legal self-defense? Do you know the law? Go to lawofselfdefense.com/variety to sign up for your legal self-defense class. Each class is tailored to the laws in your state. Attorney Andrew Branca will teach you the law. Not just what the law says, but what the judge's legal opinions say. What the jury instructions say. Sure, you could risk spending the rest of your life in prison because you followed the advice of some gun store counter jockey, or you could spend the day with the man who literally wrote the book on the law of self-defense. Carry a gun so you're hard to kill. Know the law so you're hard to convict. Go to lawofselfdefense.com/variety to sign up for a legal self-defense class in your state. And make sure to use discount code VARIETY at checkout to receive 10% off. And very quickly, if you live anywhere in North Carolina, you need to come to the August 7th, that's a Sunday, Law of Self-Defense seminar that's going to be in Raleigh. It's near RDU Airport. You have probably about 4 or 5 days to sign up for this before the price goes up $50. So go to lawofselfdefense.com, use discount code VARIETY and get the 10% off. If you sign up now, even if you didn't take the discount, you'd still be saving yourself $50 if you signed up now rather than 2 weeks from now. When the Supreme Court decision striking down abortion laws in Texas came down, my Facebook feed was filled with my pro-gun friends complaining about it. But Tiffany thinks there's a silver lining to that cloud. Well, hey, Tiffany, what do you got this week?
Hey there, Sean. Well, first of all, before we get started, I just want to give a huge shout out to my good buddy, Erin Paulette, who did a phenomenal job on her interview with BBC. So kudos to her. Yay.
Yeah, we're definitely going to talk about that on the podcast.
So did you hear about the new Supreme Court case that just came out today?
Oh, yeah. Supreme Court upheld a ban on firearm possessions for those convicted of misdemeanor domestic violence.
Yeah, I know that one ruffled some feathers, but that's actually not the one I'm talking about. I'm talking about the abortion case that came out of Texas. Have you seen that one?
Abortion? Tiffany, this is a gun podcast? What does that have to do with guns?
I know. This is a gun podcast, but I think that this case actually has a lot more in store for us than might be readily apparent at first glance. Basically, what happened is folks in Texas challenged local laws that added a whole bunch of restrictions on clinics that offer abortion in that state. And the challenge went all the way up to the Supreme Court because folks were arguing that those restrictions essentially cut off their quote-unquote right to abortion in the state.
Well, we don't have to say quote-unquote. The Supreme Court has said that it's basically a fundamental right, so let's take them at their word.
Perfect. I agree with you there. But I know that it's a serious bone of contention, so we will leave that debate for another day. As you said, this is not an abortion podcast. This is a gun podcast, so how is it relevant? I don't want to fight over that. But the reason why I think this case bears close watching on our part is some of the language from the majority opinion. I know that there is oftentimes a pretty big overlap between the pro-gun community and the pro-life community. So a lot of folks in the pro-gun community were really quick to condemn the ruling in this case, which essentially strengthens Roe v. Wade. But I think if we take a closer look, there are some really useful language in the case that I think gun advocates can use to our advantage.
So how exactly are you going to find wording in an abortion case that's going to help pro-gun advocates?
The Supreme Court essentially said that you cannot collaterally attack a constitutional right with ancillary procedural loopholes and hurdles that you have to overcome that essentially make it practically impossible to exercise the right while technically it's still on the books. And I think that that's actually something that we need to pay close attention to in our community. Let me give you a concrete example. I, as you know, I'm a university instructor. I teach at the University of Memphis. And Tennessee, I am proud to say, has recently passed a campus carry law. It applies to full-time faculty, of which I am one. So I'm really excited about it. It takes effect July 1st. So countdown to campus carry.
So I understand, basically, you just have to tell the cops that you're going to carry and you're golden, right? That's really all you got to do?
Well, that's what the statute says. That's what the legislature passed. The statute says you have to provide written notification to the law enforcement agency with jurisdiction over your campus. I actually did that several days ago. But interestingly, I got an email back from the assistant chief saying, oh, we'll get back to you with formal, you know, reporting procedures.
I've seen the exact same thing coming out of Knoxville. There's like this long form you've got to fill out and you've got to basically register yourself.
Pretty much. Now, although I was not thrilled about the whole registration process, I said to myself, look, I'll count it as a win if I'll now be able to utilize my lawfully obtained handgun carry permit while I am at work, just like any other hardworking citizen is able to do. But I'm starting to see some interesting developments. First of all, my written notice apparently did not suffice in the eyes of campus police. But now, literally 4 days before the law is to take effect, we've all gotten an email from the president saying that we have to fill out a specific form, just like you said. So my letter is not good enough, I guess. I have to put my information on their form. And they're going to report it to several different law enforcement agencies just because the University of Memphis, which is a huge campus, has its toe in various jurisdictions for whatever reason. Even if, you know, this particular satellite office has nothing to do with me and I don't have any occasion to visit that part of campus, they're still going to report the fact that I'm carrying to that campus. So the law also says that my election to carry on campus must be kept confidential. And yet I'm already seeing potential loopholes in that supposed protection that I've been provided. It's really susceptible to breach, and it's given me cause for concern. So the university is imposing all of these different little requirements and little things I have to do in order to exercise the right that I have by virtue of my carry permit. And you know, what would I do if they continue to add on more and more restrictions or more and more preconditions? What if they said, I've got to take a certain class on campus? Or what if they said that I've got to pay a fee, a maintenance fee, or you know, anything like that? They've already said that instead of simply providing written notification, which is all that's required by the statute, that I have to actually appear in person. I have to make an appointment with the chief of police to go and meet with him in person, and then they're going to evaluate my election to make sure that I am valid and eligible to carry on campus. I say, if I give you a copy of my handgun carry permit, then that's all you need to know.
At what point does this become the functional equivalent of a literacy test to vote?
Exactly. That's exactly my fear. If you draw this out to the logical extension, then it can become precisely that. And so in the same vein as literacy tests effectively prevented people from voting, even though technically on paper they still had the right to vote, this could potentially have the same effect. In other words, the campus is free because I happen to know for a fact that the university community, like most higher education communities, is staunchly anti-gun. And so it's not beyond the realm of conception in my mind that the president could very forcefully impose a series of hurdles that I would have to leap over before being able to actually exercise this right. So this is where today's Supreme Court opinion comes in. It doesn't have anything to do with abortion per se. It has to do with the reason why Texas's particular method and tactic for striking down abortion can't be upheld. The reason why their tactics were unconstitutional is because they effectively struck down the constitutional right, even though they didn't explicitly do so. And the Supreme Court said that you cannot place a substantial obstacle in the path, that's a direct quote, you cannot place a substantial obstacle in the path, quote, of people exercising constitutional rights. You cannot impose an undue burden on people who are exercising constitutional rights. Now, even though it just so happens that in today's case, the issue at bar was abortion, it doesn't matter. The standard is the same across the board. And so if I ever get to the point where I feel like the University of Memphis is imposing too many obstacles that effectively equate to a ban on the right that I possess, then I'm going to hold up today's case and say, look, the Supreme Court of the United States, as of June 2016, has said you cannot do this. I have a constitutional right to carry. The state of Tennessee has said that I can carry on university campus, and you cannot put in place all of these sort of pretextual, you know, collateral attacks to make it effectively impossible for me to do so. And I don't care if the Supreme Court's talking about abortion or marijuana or gay marriage or whatever. If a right is established as a fundamental right, nobody can build obstacles to my exercising that right. And so I think that the gun community needs to, you know, as they say where I grew up, slow your roll a little bit and don't be so anxious to jump down the throat of Justice Breyer for this abortion case, and look at the actual methodology behind the law. Because the wonderful thing, and I'm getting on my sort of lawyer soapbox here and I apologize, the wonderful thing about the state of jurisprudence in this country is that the law is supposed to be blind. Now, I know we can make a bunch of arguments about whether or not that happens in real life, but it's supposed to be blind. You're supposed to have the same standards that apply to all fundamental rights. The right, it doesn't matter. You can't change the standard when you move from one right to another. So we in the gun community need to take this case, which ironically is called Hellerstedt, believe it or not. This Hellerstedt case has really useful language that we should put in our arsenal of ways to combat those who would restrict our rights by non-traditional means.
And this might be really helpful should we ever end up in the Supreme Court on the Peruta case.
Absolutely right. You talked a little bit about the dissent in Peruta in our last podcast. And when I read some of the opinion from Hellerstedt today, I thought immediately about Peruta from the Ninth Circuit, where the majority says that local counties can institute laws that are really restrictive in terms of when concealed carry permits will be issued. And the dissent said, well, you're effectively writing people out of the Second Amendment, because even though, yeah, technically the Second Amendment's still on the books, the local sheriffs can simply make it impossible for you to actually get a handgun carry permit. Now, the issue's a little more complex than that in Peruta, but for present purposes, that's where we stand. And in my opinion, the Hellerstedt case out of Texas, this abortion case, agrees with the dissent from the Ninth Circuit in Peruta and says, look, you cannot undo constitutional rights by collateral attack. You simply can't do that. You can't impose restrictions that you argue have some legitimate purpose if the facts don't bear out that purpose to full fruition and those purported legitimate purposes are revealed to be a mere pretext for what you're ultimately trying to do, which is shut down the law. So you can't do that for abortion, which we may or may not be thrilled about that, but you also can't do that for gun rights, and all of us should be thrilled about that.
All right, Tiffany, it was good to talk with you. I'll see you again next week.
Thanks, Sean. I appreciate it.
You can follow Tiffany at frontsightpress.com.
And you know, I am definitely not letting you get away doing your segment without your intro.
I wouldn't have it any other way.
Just because you're the co-host doesn't mean I'm going to let you get away with it. And now it's time for Blue Collar Prepping with that bratty kid sister of the gun blogosphere, Erin Paulette.
Come on, every pony. It's time for Blue Collar Prepping with Erin Paulette.
So, Erin, you've been meeting with the media a lot for the past few weeks. Has your experience with prepping helped you at all with this?
Oh, has it ever. In fact, I don't think I could have gotten through my various interviews without a high degree of preparation. Now, as anyone who's seen these clips knows, I am not an expert on these matters. But here are a few things I did to prepare myself for my various interviews. First, control the medium as much as possible. My first few interviews were by email, and that was perfect for me, because not only was I able to squeeze them into my irregular schedule at my convenience, but I was able to take my time in answering the questions asked. This allowed me to give precise answers that said exactly what I wanted, because I had the luxury to write my reply, wait 15 or 20 minutes, and then come back to it with relatively new eyes to edit it if necessary. And this is something you can't do in a live interview. Second, keep your own record of the interview. Now, everyone in the gun community has learned this courtesy of Katie Couric and her creative editing, so ensure that you have a copy of what is said. And this is, of course, quite easy if you're having an email conversation, but if you're talking over the phone or on Skype or in person, it gets a bit more complicated. For Skype, there's a handy bit of freeware called the MP3 Skype Recorder, which does exactly what it says. It records both sides of a Skype conversation in MP3 format. In person, a portable recording device is great. A video camera is best if you have one, but if not, a simple digital audio recorder works. In fact, my buddy Chaplain Tim bought me a Sony digital voice recorder for my BBC interview, and it is a handy little thing. It's smaller than a cell phone, uses two AA batteries, comes with 4 gigabytes of memory, and best of all, can transfer files to your computer for easy storage. The audio quality is surprisingly good, given that it has a tiny condenser mic built into the case, and to my surprise, gunshots on the firing line didn't blow up the microphone. And all this for only $50. Now, for telephone interviews, though, you're going to need hardware. And I believe there's a specific piece of gear, Sean, that you want me to have. I'll let you handle that.
What we'd like to buy for you, which, you know, please give us money. What we'd like to buy for you is a Zoom H5 recorder. But for everybody else who's not doing a podcast and has other reasons to have multiple, more than two inputs, the Zoom H4N is a fantastic way to go. It's quite expensive at about $220. I mean, it's more than double what I would recommend for just a handy stick it in people's face, you know, $100 Zoom H1 recorder. But a Zoom H4 gives you two plugs, and you can use that like one input for a phone and one input for your microphone, and you can set up a microphone and talk on the phone and have your on one track and the phone person on the other track. So it works really well for phone interviews for like a podcast. It also works really good for phone interviews when somebody's interviewing you. So you can record both sides of it, and you record them on separate tracks even. So that's helpful.
Great. But the main thing that I want to stress for all of this is you let the reporter know you are recording the interview. And if they say, no, I don't consent, then don't do the interview because you can't trust them. Now, some states like Florida are two-party consent states, meaning that everyone being recorded needs to give their permission to be recorded. However, it's important to note that if you've given your permission for them to record you, and clearly they are okay with recording themselves, then it's my understanding, based on discussions with lawyers, although, disclaimer, this should not be taken as legal advice, that you don't need a separate agreement to have your own recording. Of course, if you live in a one-party state, then you're golden. You, of course, consent to recording yourself.
What advantages are there for you to tell them that you were recording it?
The great thing about telling them that you're recording is that it works as a deterrent, the same way concealed carry does. If the reporter knows you're recording, then it probably doesn't matter how good the recording is, or even if it caught everything. Just the knowledge that you have your own copy of the conversation ought to be sufficient to ensure good behavior.
Cool.
Third, bring a friend along if possible. When I had my BBC interview, I was incredibly nervous, but my buddy Awelawant showed up, and it was tremendously reassuring to see a friendly face. And what's more, he brought along backup recording gear, and so he had his own copy of the conversation as well. And I was also able to tell him, look, if I begin to put my foot in my mouth or otherwise screw up, you come in and interrupt me. Just knowing I had that backup, that insurance policy, really made me feel a lot better. Fourth, and we talked about this earlier, rehearse key talking points. You took a clunky answer that I had, and you boiled it down to a soundbite, and I rehearsed that sucker until I had it memorized. And even then, when Stacy asked me the expected question, do you think that if they'd had guns and pulse that the outcome may have been different, I still had that moment where I ended up trying to say two separate thoughts at once and kind of garbled a what but on camera. Now, if that happened with something that I had rehearsed, can you imagine what might have happened if I tried to wing the entire thing?
Yeah.
So rehearsing is critical. I'm one of those people who plans arguments in advance, and I practice them when I'm alone, like when I'm driving. And that's a good way to polish delivery and make sure you recall key points. Another good way to practice is to have a friend adopt the role of the interviewer and toss questions at you. And this gets you used to the feeling of being under pressure and having to answer. And unless the interview is live, realize that you have all the time in the world. If you need a few seconds to think about it, just take that time. If you flub a line, much like with this podcast, just take a deep breath for a few seconds and start again. And if you're the kind of person who does well with notes, then some flashcards with sound bites or talking points on them are also useful. And finally, remember that without you, there is no interview. So the control lies with you. Don't allow a reporter to derail you from your subject or get you into the figurative weeds of a conversation. Just say something to the effect of, that's not why I'm here today, or that's not what I consented to be interviewed about. I'm here to talk about subject matter. If you don't say anything, the worst they can do is show you not saying anything with the voiceover of, this person declined to answer that question. And so as Sean told me the day before my interview, you can win the interview and still lose the edit. If you keep to your subject, know it well, don't allow it to get off track, give short, concise answers, and let the reporter know that you'll have a record in case of any mischief, then you will likely win that edit.
But how many of us are ever going to face the media, Aaron?
Now, that's something I can't answer, Sean. Unless talking to the media is something you actively want, I hope you never have to. But it's important to realize that all of us can be called upon to represent a community at large, be it a community of preppers, gun owners, or LGBTQ individuals. And the last thing you want is to give an offhand remark that depicts everyone in your community in a bad light.
Now, I have a bit of experience in this area, in that I once led an entire protest and was like the public face of Grassroots North Carolina when Gabby Giffords came to town.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the hard parts about dealing with gun owners and media is that gun owners want, when somebody finally sticks a camera in their face, they want to give the grand unified theory of why you should keep your hands off my guns.
Shall not be infringed.
Well, they don't even get that. I mean, if that's all they did was scream shall not be infringed, it wouldn't be a problem. It's that they'll give you an hour-long answer to a question that requires kind of a yes-no. It's like, look, you're not here to demonstrate to the reporter how comprehensively they are wrong. You're here to give a little soundbite. Reporters are there to get you to be the live-action prop in the story that they have already written in their head. If you give them the opportunity and you give them close enough to what they want you to say, they will use that and ignore everything else. So your job is to stay on message, and God help you if you ever have to try to keep all the cats together, because let me tell you, gun owners, trying to get them all to stand in the same place is like herding cats. You have to explain to them, here's our message. Here's our message. This is what we're here to say, and stay on that message. You're not there to give the grand unified field theory. You're there to protest a specific issue or to get some particular point across. That was one thing that you did absolutely brilliantly above all other things, is you didn't let her drag you off topic. Because if she'd have found something and wanted to, she'd have used it. I'd have seen it. We'd all look bad. But you stayed in your lane. You talked about it later. You said, I'm not here for that. It's not something that I'm prepared to talk about. Let me get you to an expert. And well, what are they going to do? Are they going to put you on camera and say, well, she says she's not an expert in every last single thing? No, they're not going to put that on camera.
Yeah.
They ran into a wall, they back up, and they went somewhere else. If you're interested in this, if you think you're ever going to have to deal with the media, or even if you just want to know what kind of a mess they make of the actual news, I'm going to recommend, in addition to all of these different recording devices, a book called The 10 Commandments of Propaganda by Brian Ants Patrick. It'll be in the show notes. You should read it. It'll give you a great insight into what the media actually does and how it operates. Not only can you subscribe or donate to the podcast, you can also make a contribution to the LGBT Training Ammo Fund. Go to gunblogvarietycast.com and click on the LGBT Training Ammo Fund donation button in the right sidebar. I'll use this money to pay for range fees, targets, and yes, ammo for the people I teach. And thanks for your support. And I'd like to thank listener James for his generous donations, both to the LGBT Ammo Fund and also to the Get Aaron a Multi-Track Recorder Fund. Thank you, James. I really appreciate it. The podcast really appreciate it. And I guarantee you the people I'm taking to the range are going to appreciate it. This week, Senator Jeanne Shaheen does a radio interview where she tells all of us what she thinks of people who own guns designed after 1950. You know what that means. Time for another patented weird audio fisk in this week in anti-gun nuttery. So hey, Weird, what do you got for us this week?
So many anti-gun politicians are up in arms demanding more gun control in the wake of the terror attack at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando. Last week we had the president's speech. This week it's Democrat Senator Jeanne Shaheen during an interview on radio station WKBK in her home state of New Hampshire. The tone for this whole interview is set by the crazy introduction from the host.
We talk about the types of guns or the type of ammunition or the size of the clips that are available. That fine, you can have your handguns, you can buy weapons for hunting, but why do we need these semi-automatic weapons that seem to be the weapon of choice by these criminals? If we can't even expand background checks or expand the list of, you know, people who can buy weapons, how is it possible that we could ever even make ground when it comes to the types of guns that people own?
First up, why haven't the anti-gunners gotten the message yet? George Washington didn't cross the Delaware River to get to his duck blind. The Second Amendment isn't about hunting. And moreover, the countless people buying guns and getting their concealed weapon permits are overwhelmingly from urban and suburban locations and are not doing so to hunt ducks or deer. On to the dirty truth. He says, you can have your handguns, but not semi-automatic weapons that are the choice of criminals. Well, first up, handguns for the most part are semi-auto. But he also said clip, so we can simply note that he knows nothing about guns. But when it comes to crime statistics, handguns are the chosen tool of criminals. Heck, most of the anti-gun groups that have been around since the birth of modern gun control in the 60s and 70s were founded with the intent of banning handguns in America. That's why the Coalition to Ban Handguns and Handgun Control Incorporated changed their names. They are CSGV and Brady Campaign, respectively. While handguns are the number one choice of criminals, they're also the number one choice of people for personal protection. And neither of these groups want to give up their guns. So yeah, talk about banning rifles, background checks, a terror watch list. It'll accomplish nothing at all. And you're wondering why you're in such a political quagmire.
The fact is, the AR-15, the gun that Mateen used, that's a weapon of war. It's advertised as being able to do technologically advances in killing people that previous weapons have been unable to do.
Let's ignore the fact that it was a SIG MCX rifle, not an AR. These people don't know clips from magazines or semi-auto from full-auto, so we can't expect them to get the rifle correct either. The AR-15 or any other semi-auto sporting rifle is not a weapon of war, plain and simple. No military issues them, no military uses them, none of the guns you can find at your local gun shop are even being considered for military use. As far as the advances in killing people that other weapons are unable to do, where did she even get that load of crap? I mean, I don't even know where to start. It's one of those statements that's so bad it's not even wrong. As Wolfgang Pauli once said, what you said was so confused that one could not tell whether it was nonsense or not.
Somebody who's buying that kind of a weapon isn't buying it for target shooting. They're not buying it to go out and hunt deer. You don't need an AK-47 or an AR-15 to hunt deer.
They aren't buying AR-15s to target shoot and hunt deer? Sean, you have an AR-15 pattern rifle. What'd you buy it for?
Well, home defense, neighborhood defense, and fun at the range. Once I get a 300 blackout barrel, I'll use it with my suppressor and hunt deer or pigs or something. Wouldn't even mind taking a shot at some coyotes with the current 5.56 barrel.
Yeah, I have an FAL pattern rifle. I own it for a lot of reasons, but the only thing I've actually done with it is take it to the range and shoot targets. One day I'd like to bag a deer with it. I mean, 308 Winchester is one of the most preferred cartridges for white-tailed deer. Can you hunt deer with a bolt action? May I say, military-grade sniper rifle? As well as pull clothes and paper with, well, really anything. Yeah, but those aren't as versatile. As the modern sporting rifles are great for hunting, target shooting, trading new shooters, but they're also great for personal protection. Is she upset that Americans are being frugal?
They're buying it to do bad things, and we need to recognize that and address it.
What?
Not only is she horribly insulting to the massive amount of Americans who own a modern semi-auto rifle, but it's demonstrably false. AR-15 pattern rifles are selling like hotcakes, and companies are producing similar variants like the SIG MCX to meet market demand. Of course, we just pointed out that yes, people are buying them to hunt and target shoot. Heck, I know a ton of veterans who bought an AR-15 to get into the shooting sports because it's a weapon system similar to rifles they used in the service. And of course, while all of this is happening, violent crime is going down. Rude, insulting, and demonstrably false.
If the NRA claims to have 4.5 million members, that would only be about 1% of the population. How can that small a minority have such control over our elections and the legislative process?
Well, sadly, I think it's because they are able to influence members of Congress, and they do that because they have a very strong lobby, because they spend a lot of money, and because they come in and finance ads and election kinds of activities in a way that has an influence.
One thing we don't hear enough of is how damn insulting the Democrats' view of the general population is. She's saying that the NRA is simply buying elections. They pay politicians to speak favorably of them and buy ad space, and the idiotic booger-eating populace just turns around and votes against common sense. No! First up, if money bought elections, Why does Michael Bloomberg have only a handful of narrow victories and a pile of bitter defeats? He's been outspending the gun lobby in orders of magnitude. Odd how anti-gun money doesn't go as far as pro-gun money does. We know why. Even if we aren't in the NRA, or even like the NRA, we know how insane the anti-gun proposals are. We know that background checks and the terror list or weapon or magazine bans wouldn't have solved any of this. Yet that's the reaction of the anti-gun politicians. Further, they liken us to terrorists and criminals simply because we choose quality tools for our hunting, sporting, and yes, personal protection. Senator Shaheen doesn't seem to be winning any friends on this issue. You wonder why her side is losing.
All right, Weird. It was good to talk with you. I'll see you again next week.
See you next week, Sean.
In addition to appearing here, Weird is a regular host on The Squirrel Report and blogs at weirdworld.com. That's weerdworld.com.
Plug of the week. Quick plug to JM Custom Kydex. I've been carrying in a JM Custom Kydex holder for several years now. I ended up with another holster that my brother took video of me drawing in a class and said, "Do you see how you're yanking your pants up around your armpits? That's a good indication that the holster you're using is not very good. Why don't you buy the same holster I've got?" And he shows me his JM Custom Kydex outside the waistband holster. So I bought one. And then I bought another one for the same gun, but for a gun that has a light on it. And now I'm not carrying with the light on it anymore. I'm back to the original holster. And I am brutal with my equipment. I'm, you know, running around, flopping on the ground, playing with the dog. Really, I've used it hard. And the only problems that I've ever had is I've cracked the belt loops. And I call up JM Custom Kydex and say, "Hey, I've broken a belt loop. Can you send me some more?" And they come in the mail. The customer service is fantastic. The prices are reasonable. And it is just a fantastic holster. So JM Custom Kydex at jmcustomkydex.com. And let them know that Sean from the Gunblog Variety Cast sent you. Not that we'll get anything out of it, but it's kind of nice to know that somebody out there is plugging you. So let them know that that's where you found out. Well, that's our show for the week.
Find the show notes at gunblogvarietycast.com/episode-98.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Gunblog Variety Cast. Music courtesy of Rob Allen at blog.roballen.com. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and Google Play Music. This podcast is made possible by the Firearms Policy Coalition and by contributions from listeners like you.
This is a URS production.